Welcome to the second part of QFT, where hopefully we'll learn about higher spin fields. Or spin one and spin half and spin one particles. So this is basically our goal for the next week and a half. So the plan for the lectures is today and maybe tomorrow. Today and tomorrow, I will tell you about, say, classical spinners. Because spinners are, you may be unfamiliar with spinners, so that's why I'm actually going to spend some time on spinners. And there are different kinds of spinners, so even their classical properties can be varied. So it's worthwhile to think a little bit about the, about their properties. And then hopefully tomorrow or Monday, we'll quantize spinners. So quantum field theory of fermions. And then we are going to revisit a theory that you've already seen. Dan told you about the scalar Yukawa theory, that is when you treat the a nucleon as a scalar particle and they exchange mesons. So, but we are now going to have a spinner Yukawa theory. So the good thing about the spinner Yukawa theory is that it allows us to develop the Feynman rules for spinners without the added complication of having vector bosons. So after we have discussed this, we're going to see how to quantize the Maxwell field, how to quantize. And because the Maxwell field has this added symmetry, quote-unquote symmetry, called a gate symmetry, there will be subtleties associated with that quantization process. And then hopefully by Thursday and Friday, we will be able to put all of this together and start talking about quantum electrodynamics. So the plan might change a little bit depending on how things go, but that's the rough outline, okay? So why spinners? And you probably know the answer to this question, otherwise you wouldn't be here. But still, a few brief comments are in order. So for our purposes, the most important answer is that, when you take spinners and you quantize them, you get fermions. In 3+1 dimensions, this is a theorem called, this is part of a theorem called the spin statistics theorem. And look around you, we are mostly made out of fermions held together by bosons, right? Well, that's just a point of view, but the other thing is that, so for physics, we need spinners. Mathematically, spinners are also interesting, those of you who are of the more mathematical bent of mind. And they form a representation of historically, okay, spinners represent, they form a representation of the ON, SON, SO, 1 comma n minus 1, this kind of groups. And in fact, you know, Clifford in 19th century, guy's name was, I think, Cliff, yeah. He came up with the algebra of spinners, or something very closely related to this, which is known as Clifford algebra. So, you know, there's this mathematical connection. But that is not all. Spinners in the second half of the 20th century and even today continue to play a very, very important and pivotal role in mathematics, in geometry. So there's this towering theorem in geometry called the Atiyah-Singer index theorem, which is about, it's a very important theorem in the field of geometry and topology, and it talks about the zero modes of the Dirac operator being the operator which enters the Dirac equation for spin half particles. So I think that's how it was spelled. Yeah. So the Atiyah-Singer index theorem, and then spinners and, fermions and bosons also form a very important ingredient in an extension of particle physics, kind of conjectured extension of particle physics, which are called supersymmetric theories. So supersymmetry is a conjectured symmetry of nature. We still haven't found any evidence for supersymmetry in our universe, but supersymmetric quantum field theories are very interesting objects, and they are key to building string theory, and they're also being proposed as solutions to some of the theoretical puzzles of the standard model, such as the hierarchy problem, although because of lack of evidence of supersymmetry, people are trying to come with alternative ways of solving the hierarchy problem. But supersymmetry plays a very key role in theoretical physics and also in mathematics. Okay, so I think that's a waffle enough. Now let us get to the definition of a spinner. Any question about this? I mean, mind you that, you know, any answer you get is going to be necessarily vague. Okay, good. So, okay, what is the definition of a spinner? So suppose that, I'm just going to give you the linear algebraic definition. Suppose that we are in even dimensional space-time, okay? And I'm going to relax this at some point, but let's start. Let's define a spinner in an even dimensional space-time. And my signature will be, I'll stick to the same convention as Dan, so it's mostly minus. Right. So given this, a spinner is a representation. So spinner is a representation of the Dirac algebra. And I mean representation within quotes because I don't want to be very sort of group theoretically rigorous here. But the Dirac algebra is given by this guy, this equation. So in other words, we have a set of objects, which we will assume to be matrices, where mu goes from 1 to dot dot d minus 1, and they form that algebra. So what mathematicians call a Clifford algebra is a bigger object than the Dirac algebra. The Dirac algebra is like a subset of that, but the Clifford algebra in any dimension can be generated from the Dirac algebra. So morally speaking, they're the same. Yes. Yes. So now, being physicists, we'll immediately, you know, think of these guys as matrices. Now the problem is to figure out what is the dimensionality of these matrices, okay? However, before doing so, because let's, you know, we see that these, that the Dirac algebra implies that the gamma zero squares to one, whereas gamma I, the spatial components, square to minus one, where I goes from 1 to d minus 1. Okay, so by ijk, I mean the spatial components. Yes, David? Exactly, yes. Yes. What David was saying is that there is a unit matrix here. Also, I would like to define this object to be the anti-commutator of gamma mu and gamma nu. That makes my life easier. Okay. So thus we see that the gamma zeros have real eigenvalues, and you know, gamma I's have imaginary eigenvalues. So we can define, the gamma zero being Hermitian and gamma I anti-Hermitian matrices. Okay? Okay. So now, whenever we are trying to build representation of something, we want to create some creation and annihilation operator out of those guys, right? That's something that we do instinctively as physicists. So let's define k plus one pairs of ladder operators like so. So here we have k plus one pairs of ladder operators, and the way I've constructed them, they are not Hermitian, but taking the Hermitian conjugate flips the plus minus sign. And why are we calling them ladder operators? Because it is easy to verify that these guys satisfy these fermionic anti-commutation relationships. So in the tutorial yesterday, there was this optional problem which showed that if you have an operator A and A dagger which satisfies an anti-commutation relationship like this, then there is, you can create this Hamiltonian, which is A dagger A, and then the commutation relationship with that Hamiltonian slash number operator, that operator with this A and A dagger is the same as the commutation relationship for the creation and annihilation operator that we all know. Yes, you're right. So you remember, do you remember from yesterday's tutorial you had A and A dagger and they satisfied this? And then you had some guy, A dagger A, and then you can say, ask, what is this? You can show that this is it this A dagger, right? And right. Okay. Yes, Elon?
There has to be K as an
integer,
right?
Yes. Because D is integer. Yeah, we are not doing renormalization or anything. Yes. So, right, K is an integer, sorry. Yeah.
So that means D is even.
Yeah, D is even. We are, for now, we are sticking to even dimensional spacetime. The odd dimension is just one step. Once we have constructed an even dimensional representation, the odd just follows very easily, as I'll show. Okay? Okay. So, I'm not going to write down the N for these guys, but what I want to emphasize is that there is an interpretation of these guys as creation and annihilation operators, right? So let me now define psi to be a k plus one tuple. Okay? So it is a K plus one tuple, right? So now these guys will act, if they have the interpretation of being some matrix, they're going to act on some vector space, right? So there is some, let's assume that there is an element in that vector space which is annihilated all the gamma minuses, okay? So no matter which gamma minus you take, if you apply this to this vacuum, so don't worry why I've written written minus halves here, that this is zero, okay? So this state, we can call it the vacuum. So now we can build up our representation by applying on this vacuum the creation operator gamma pluses. So a general state would be, given by so this is a little bit of a complicated formula, but once I've written it down, it'll be fine. Right, so a general state would be given by basically these guys acting on the vacuum. But if one of these guys acts on the vacuum twice, what happens? Kaput, right? Zero. And that's because of these relationships. So in this string of creation operators, these gamma pluses, these raising operators, can only occur once. If it does occur, we say the value of the SK there is half. If it does not occur, then we assign that value to be minus half. So minus half plus half is what? Sorry? Minus half and plus half, what does that add up to? Zero, yeah. So anytime SK, one of these S's have minus half value, they drop out. So what we have established is that any element of these guys can be labeled by a k plus one tuple where each entry is either plus half or minus half. Okay? And if all of them have minus half, and that is our vacuum. Okay? Okay, this way of looking at it, so I should really say the continuation of that is that SA is plus half if the corresponding guy is present, you know, in that formula, or minus half if the corresponding guy is absent. Okay. And so let me just write down gamma A plus. Let's give this a name, because it's important enough. So a particular for a, okay. So gamma A plus for a given A can only appear in dagger once. So now let's switch to physicist language and call this guy psi of cosi. Right? So this guy is, so we'll call this so what is the dimensionality of this object? It is 2 to the power k plus 1. Or 2 to the power d by 2, right? That is the dimensionality of this object. Because this can be either there or not there. Here or so either of these guys can have two values. So it is 2 to the power k plus 1. Because there are k plus 1 entries here. The number of different kinds of entries you can have is 2 to the power k plus 1. So that is the dimensionality of the representation. And we called, so the vector space spanned by these guys over the complex numbers is what we call a Dirac spinner. So the vector space, spanned by psi of psi over C is called a Dirac spinner. So most of the time, so at some point I'll, yes, who came first? Yeah, S's, yes. S.
And they're all added to 1/2?
Yes, so S can take only value plus what, plus half or minus half. If it takes plus half, then you have some gamma, you know, appearing in this expression. If it takes minus half, it doesn't appear in that expression.
So there should be all 1/2 added to S.
Oh, yes, of course. Yes. Same? Okay, good. Yes. Because that's how I'm defining them. You know, my rules. We could have done plus or minus one, but you know, because S's have a kind of interpretation of as spins, of that's why it's plus half minus half is basically what's being preferred. Yes.
Call the vector space the direction
Yes.
or elements
Elements of it, yes. Yes. Okay. From now on, I'm gonna use probably the. Okay. So for most purposes now, we'll set d equals to 4, although I'll make a comment about d equals to 5, which you're all, I'm sure, dying to know. Okay, so this is all very nice, but what does it have to do with the word spinners, which means spinning, which means has something to do with rotation, which means something to do with Lorentz transformation or its subgroup, right? So hiding in all of this is a representation of the Lorentz group. And so let us define sigma matrices, not sums, as commutator of the Dirac matrices. So this guy is antisymmetric in mu and nu, right? So how many independent gamma mu nus are, sorry, sigma mu nus are there in 4 dimensions? 6, which is suspiciously the same number of dimensions that the Lorentz group has, right? So now, you know, you can just, you know, after your dinner tonight, you will work out for yourself, if you are a good sci student or a good physics master student from whatever university you are, you will go and work out this relationship using the Dirac algebra. So this is just, you just have to break up the commutator into this object in terms of anticommutators and use the Dirac algebra. So once you have done that, you can go a step further. So no movie night for you guys tonight. This is better than Adam's Family. You can go and prove this amazingly beautiful formula, which I have to look up every time I write it down. I'm sure I can like memorize it, but okay, I may have misplaced an index here or there, but we've got Thomas and Elon and the other students to figure that out. Anyway, do you guys know what this algebra is? Has anyone seen it before? It is part of, yeah, it's a sub-algebra of the Poincaré algebra. This is the Lorentz algebra. This is the Lie algebra that is associated with the Lie group SO1, comma 3, otherwise known as the Lorentz group. Okay? I think Gang told you about this, but you completely forgot. So think of these as generators, and this is the, yes. Yes, you're right. Okay, which one should it be? So mu and nu, so it's all antisymmetric. So let's see, that would be mu, and this is nu, rho here. So it should be rho here. Right? So these guys can change, yeah. So this is the Lorentz algebra. Named after the guy who almost figured out special relativity, but didn't. So now, let's look at, if you look at some of the Lorentz algebra now divides into two sets, naturally. If you look at the spatial components, so the generators, they generate rotations. And you can very easily verify using the hermiticity properties of the gamma matrices that these guys are Hermitian. Whereas the zero I components of the Lorentz algebra generate boosts. And they are anti-Hermitian. Okay, so this is where mathematics diverges from physics, or physics diverges from mathematics, because this is an important distinction. You know, mathematicians are usually interested in representation of the SON or ON groups. Mathematicians don't seem very aware of the fact that time exists. But the fact that, you know, a bunch of these guys, because of the signature of space-time, a bunch of these generators are not Hermitian means that the group that you form by exponentiating these generators, you know, they do not form a unitary representation of the Lorentz group, right? But they're not unitary matrices. If you take these guys and say, okay, I'm going to say e to the power I of real. So this is some real parameter, and this is Hermitian or anti-Hermitian. For rotation, these guys would be Hermitian. They'll be picked from there. For boost, it'll be picked from these guys. So for real parameters, if you choose to parameterize your group in real parameters, then, you know, this is not going to be a unitary matrix, right? And this is related to a theorem in group theory, which put negatively says that there are no finite dimensional unitary representation of a non-compact group. Now, the Lorentz group is a non-compact group because the boosts, you can just keep on boosting, you know? And the rotation subgroup is a compact subgroup, but the Lorentz group itself is a non-compact group. And therefore, there is no finite dimensional unitary representation of the Lorentz group. So let's write it down. There are no finite dimensional unitary representation of the Lorentz group, okay? And you might say, okay, that's problematic because we are doing quantum mechanics and we probably want things to be unitary. And you know, how can our quantum field say, does this mean that our theory is not unitary? The thing is that our theory is unitary, and we'll see that the Hilbert space that we will be working with, the space which will represent the particles, they form an infinite dimensional representation of the Lorentz group, and they will actually be unitary. That representation will be unitary. So there are lots of representations here, so we'll just take care not to get lost in them. So I'm just going to kind of, jump a little bit forward and tell you how this is going to work out, and we'll come back to that, later on. So in quantum theory, so in quantum field theory, I should say, what will happen is that this guy, the Dirac spinner, now I'm explicitly, okay, let's put here, explicitly, referring to its spinorial index. So it'll go from 1 to 4 in 4 dimensions. So this is the spinorial index. So that means that the gamma matrices will have AB as spinorial index, and these indices will act on these indices. So in the quantum theory, this guy will become an operator. Okay, let's go to that side now. So everybody got the schedule change notice? We're just flipping the tutorials and the classes next week. So all the classes will be in the morning and the tutorials in the afternoon. Is that all right? Not tomorrow, next week. So, okay. That way I can actually tease something interesting and have that in the tutorial rather than having something boring in the tutorial and then teach something interesting. So what happens is that, as you saw in Dan's lectures, you start with some classical field in this, and then you promote those guys to a quantum field, and those quantum field then act on some Hilbert space of particle states, or a Fock space, or whatever you want to call it. So now the thing is that when you make a Lorentz transformation of your system, these operators that Dan showed, they don't really change much because they are scalars. But spinners will change in the following way. So you have some Lorentz transformation. So you have some lab, and every point in lab has some coordinate, and you make some active transformation. So this is an element of the Lorentz group, the defining representation of the Lorentz group. And then this will have some effect on the, this will have some effect on the operators that act on your Hilbert space. In our case, we are interested in those operators being spinners. And this will be the way that this will happen. Okay? So this, okay, so, okay, I made a mistake here. This should be gamma. So perhaps a better way, a more transparent way of writing this is that under this Lorentz transformation, our spin field will go to something psi prime of A of x, and there'll be S of A of B, and this will be a function of the Lorentz transformation acting on the B, and the because we are doing an active transformation, the argument will transform in that way. Okay. Right. But I will come back to this. But this thing is actually related to our original spin field through a unitary transformation, but these unitary transformation, they do not act on the spinorial index. They act on the index that'll, well, they act on the Hilbert space, because the size will become operator when you quantize on some Hilbert space. So that means that you can associate some kind of index to them, right? Which will be the index on the Hilbert space. So these U's are operators acting on that Hilbert space, whereas S is the representation that we are talking about right now. That these S matrices are the spin representation of the Lorentz group, okay? And therefore, they act on the spinorial indices. Yes. Yeah, so I should really be calligraphically consistent. Right. So let me remind you what the forms of the defining gamma matrices, the Lorentz transformations were. So because there are three rotations and three boosts, we can use in an antisymmetric, object with two indices, where to parameterize our elements of the Lorentz group. So what I'm saying is that here, omega, zero I, they are the boost parameters. Whereas omega ij are the rotation parameters, okay? And these are antisymmetric. So omega alpha beta is antisymmetric. And this antisymmetry ensures that there are only six of independent of these guys. So, and these six guys, these MAB, these are 4x4 matrices. There are six of them, which are the generators of the Lorentz group in space-time. Okay, and I think Gang gave you the explicit form of these matrices, and in my convention, the matrix elements of MAB are given by so this has to be antisymmetric in alpha and beta. So that has to be minus sign here, and then this has to be beta. This can only be mu, and this can only be nu, and this can only be alpha, right? So these are the generators of the Lorentz group in space-time. Does everyone understand that? Yes. Now, what we want to do is that we want to use the same parameters to label elements of these S matrices, right? Because these S matrices form a representation of the Lorentz group. Therefore, they should be labeled, they should be parameterized by the same parameters. Therefore, S's should be given by the exponentiation of I by 2, the same omegas, and now the generators, as I promised, those are the generators. So take those guys. This is, and then we take the A, B element of this. So these are the this S matrices, I've written the elements explicitly, A and B. This S matrices form the Lorentz the spinorial representation of the Lorentz group. Okay, clear? Okay. So now I told you to work out this formula after dinner today, but let me tell you a little bit more about that formula. So if I use my definition of M alpha beta over there in that formula, then that formula becomes a little bit more transparent. Its physical or geometric or physical meaning becomes a little bit more transparent. And basically, that formula becomes gamma mu nu, gamma rho, M mu nu, take the sigma rho element of it. Okay? So what does this formula mean? It's related to the fact that the gamma matrices have a, what you might call a space-time index. And a couple of spin index or spinner index. Okay? So when you make a Lorentz transformation of your underlying laboratory, you would expect something which has a space-time index to transform with M as a generator. But something which also has this other new kind of spinner index to transform according to these S's. And this is basically represents that at a Lie at an algebra level, that the left-hand side is saying that the spinor index of gamma is transforming with respect to the spinorial representation of the Lorentz group. And the space-time index, rho, is transforming in the usual Lorentz, the defining representation of the Lorentz group, okay? So this is the meaning of this relationship. Now, except that I've used the language improperly. The gamma matrices, once you fix a representation, are just numbers in flat space-time. They do not transform. But they satisfy this property, which makes it look like, you know, roughly, you know, in a physicist/vulgarian's tongue, as if they transform. So you will come across many physicists who will say, oh, gamma matrices transforms like this. And this is what they mean, you know? So, you know, physicists like being vulgar. right? So keep in mind that the, okay, anyway. Yeah? Okay, so in some sense, you know, if gamma were physical objects, you know, under some infinitesimal Lorentz transformation, it'll have some transformation like this, gamma rho, but it also has A, B elements in it. So it'll be something where, you know, the gamma, these indices will be acted upon by the generator of the spin representation of the Lorentz group. And then there will be a term where it'll be M acting on the space-time index of the gamma matrix, right? And this is basically what I mean, is that, and the fact that this is invariant under the Lorentz group in some sense is expressed by this fact. Right, so, the space-time indices tell you which gamma matrix you have, and the matrix indices tell you the spinor index. Okay. Okay. Good. So the thing is that, you know, gamma matrices will be part of expressions involving spinors, which do transform, you know, under the Lorentz group in that way. And for those expressions to be covariant or invariant, the gamma matrices will have to have very special properties, right? And that's the key property that the gamma matrices must have, okay? Okay, I feel like I'm really boring you guys. So I'll step it up. So there are all kinds of nice structures related hidden in these in the Lorentz group. Sorry, this in the spinorial representation of the Lorentz group. And let me just mention some, although I will not dwell on it. So for example, if you define Ji's to be say half of epsilon ijk sigma ij and K i's to be gamma zero I, then you get the more familiar looking. So this is the more familiar looking version of the Lorentz algebra. So there is a subalgebra which is the rotation, but the boosts do not form a closed subalgebra. So the boosts do not form a group. Something I'm sure you have come across in some special relativity course at some point in your life. Right. So, now that we have constructed the Dirac spinner, the question is this a reducible representation? So is psi reducible? And the answer is yes. Psi is not an irreducible representation. So to see this, let's define a gamma, a new gamma called gamma 5 by I by 4 epsilon mu nu rho sigma gamma mu gamma nu gamma rho gamma sigma, where this is the Levi-Civita symbol. So by symbol, I mean that this has a value plus 1 or minus 1 in any reference, any coordinate system. So this is actually not a tensor. It's a tensor density. Hopefully, that's a distinction you'll learn at some point. But for now, just think of this as epsilon 0, 1, 2, 3 is 1. Any even permutation is minus 1. Odd permutations are plus 1. Okay. So this means that gamma 5, if you work it out, is given by gamma 0, gamma 1, gamma 2, gamma 3. Okay. And so gamma 5 has some interesting properties. The way I've defined it, it's Hermitian. It also anti-commutes with the elements of the Dirac algebra, well, the gamma matrices, I should say, where gamma mu is 1, 2, 3, 4, 0, 1, 2, 3. And gamma 5 squares to 1. So this suggests how, if we were actually not in even dimension, but in one higher odd dimension, how we could add, how we could extend the Dirac algebra. We could extend the Dirac algebra by adding to it this guy, or its minus, depending on your convention and stuff like that, right? But then when we did the annihilation creation operator game, when we paired up the gamma matrices, this guy would not have anyone to pair up with. So it would not actually play any role in the construction of the representation, okay? Therefore, in D plus one dimension, the dimensionality of the Dirac representation remains the same. So we can say in general, in D dimension, the Dirac matrices, or sorry, the Dirac representation of the Dirac spinner has the integer component of D by two components, okay? Complex entries. Is that clear? Sorry. Why so if you go to five dimension, the Dirac spinners in five dimensions are also four dimensional, column matrices. Because gamma five is not playing a role in the construction, because that I outlined before. Yes. Yes. And the square brackets mean you take the integer part of D by two. So in four dimensions, this is four complex dimensional, right? In five dimensions, it's also four. In six dimensions, it's eight. In seven dimensions, it's still eight. Okay? Yes.
So that's the dimension of the spinner representation?
Right. Of the Dirac representation. Yeah. Those, the psi that I wrote down, those are, that's a number of entries it has, but complex entries. Okay. So the Dirac matrices are 2D by this times this dimensional. Okay. So let's now come back to four dimensions. It's good that we live in four dimensions. Why? Because gamma five commutes with all these gamma, anti-commutes with gamma matrices, gamma five will commute with bilinear combination of them, right? So that means that gamma five will commute with the generators of the Lorentz, the spinorial generators of the Lorentz group. So this implies that the spinner representation on which those sigma matrices act will break up into eigenspaces of gamma five. Okay, so this means that like the spinner representation on which, so these guys and their exponentiation act on, is reducible with the smaller reps, which are E reps, I guess. Sorry, my I don't have a very mathematics language, mathematical language, so you'll have to excuse my infelicities of my expression when I talk about mathematical stuff. The smaller representations. Labeled by the eigenvalues of gamma 5, okay? And what are the eigenvalues of gamma 5? I believe that was a grammatically correct question or. So gamma 5 squares to 1, it is Hermitian. What are the eigenvalues of gamma 5? Gamma 5 doesn't square to itself. Gamma 5 squares to 1. If gamma 5 squared to itself, then its eigenvalues would be 0 and 1. Plus or minus 1, yeah, right? So, okay, good. So its eigenvalues are plus minus 1. So we can now construct projection operators which will project down, project onto the irreducible representations. And those projection operators are 1 minus gamma 5 and PL and PR, which will have some interpretation at some point. And you can verify that they satisfy, these guys satisfy the usual relationship for projectors. So these are projectors. Okay, so, oh dear, how time flies. Okay, so this allows us to now define some irreducible representation of the Lorentz group. And these are known as Weyl spinners. So psi L is so Weyl spinners. So the left-handed Weyl spinner is psi L, and this is given by the P of L acting on some Dirac spinners. And similarly, the right-handed guy, it's denoted by psi R, is this, okay? So the Dirac representation is reducible. Because now, if we went to 5 dimensions, we would include gamma 5 in the construction of our Lorentz algebra. So if we were in 5 dimensions, this gamma mu nu, which did I use half or something? I think this was what, yeah. This would now include gamma 5. So therefore, we could not use gamma 5 to reduce the representation to left-handed and right-handed spinners. So in odd dimensions, you know, the Dirac, you know, representation is not reducible in this way. Okay? But we are not in odd dimensions. Okay. Right. Well, yeah. Okay, that's a very good question. Gamma 6. The way I defined gamma 5 was through the Levi-Civita symbol, right? If I do that in six dimensions with the Levi-Civita symbol in six dimensions, we get something that is proportional to the identity. So, okay. Sorry? In five dimensions. So gamma six does not, you know, the analogous construction for gamma six doesn't exist, you're right. Okay, good. So there is a particular basis in which the gamma mu's, the gamma matrices look very simple, and it's a representation. We call those representation when we choose a particular basis. And the representation in which gamma 5 is diagonal is called the Weyl basis. So the Weyl basis, it's defined to be the basis in which gamma 5 has this form. So it's a 2x2 matrix. That is called the Weyl representation. Okay. So this is a representation of the gamma matrix. So in the Weyl basis, the Dirac matrices are given by these expressions. Gamma 0 is given by this. So these are all 2x2 matrices. And gamma I, the spatial part guys, are given by, okay, where? Sigma I are the usual Pauli matrices. I am assuming that everyone knows the algebra of Pauli matrices. Now, if we introduce the notation where gamma mu, where mu now goes from 0 to 3, to be 1, the 0th component is the identity, the 2x2 identity matrix, and the spatial components are the Pauli matrices. And sigma bar of mu as 1, comma minus the Pauli matrices, then of course we can write these two relationship in a single expression. So this is a very, very often used representation of the gamma matrices. And this representation of the gamma matrix is called the Weyl representation. Okay. So I think I started about 10 minutes after, and I'm sure. So I'll end 10 minutes after. I hope that's all right, David. Okay, good. See, I got a direct connection with God. Okay. Question? Okay, yeah. We'll get to that. All in good time. If I tell you the meaning of life in the first lecture, why would you stick around for the others, right? Yes?
Our notation for sigma.
Yeah?
Why do you know that a sigma bar instead of just lowering the index?
No, it's actually so the bars are related to the left-handed and the right-handed representations. So which we'll see have very, very, they're different representations. I've just told you that, but you know, so the bars kind of is a shorthand for doing that. We could have used tilde, but You're right, because they also have to enter into expressions where there are derivatives, and derivatives will come with their own space-time indices, and usually it's delta downstairs mu, so you know we have to contract them with left-handed and right-handed spinners, so that's why, but yeah, that's good. In the higher dimensions, it will, yeah. Okay, now, so in the Weyl basis, the generators of the Lorentz group, I think I wrote half there, which should be, no, actually, that's fine, yeah. They look like this. So they have a block diagonal form, which is not surprising because, as we said, that you know these are reducible, right? So in the Weyl basis, in the Weyl representation, the fact that the Dirac representation is reducible becomes manifest. So, you know, consider an infinitesimal Lorentz transformation. So, infinitesimal infinitesimal Lorentz transformation. Then, under that, under such a, we have the, we can write the exponential this becomes 1 minus I omega 0 I. So these are the boosts and these are the rotations. And I'm gonna just choose our x to be 0 so we won't have to worry about expanding the, you know, expanding the argument of the space time argument of our spinners. Okay? So now if I use this representation, we see that the left-handed bit transforms like 1 minus, let's now call the boosts beta, and this under bar means it's a 3 vector. This is my notation for a 3 component object, which is completely different from the rest of the worlds. So, because Dan used this, right? So this is my this. So these are the boosts, and then these are the rotations. So these are the boosts. These are the rotations. So we call this representation spin half comma zero representation. In books, you will also find this being referred to the 2,1 representation. By this, I mean that I'm making reference to the actual spin of the objects, whereas in this notation, it is referring to the dimensionality of the representation. So how does psi r transform? Yes? Zero means that it transforms trivially under this guy. So psi r transforms in this way. under the same. So this is the zero. This is the left-handed representation. There's the right-handed representation, and this is sometimes 1, 2. That I put under bar there because some people use bold. So see that these two guys do not transform in the same way. To prove that they're actually in equivalent transformation, let me show that they are actually related by complex conjugation. So you can verify this nice relationship that the complex conjugate of the Pauli matrices are related to themselves through this transformation. So this is not a similarity transformation. Why is that? Although sigma 2 is its own inverse, but there's a minus sign. So the complex conjugate is not related to the, but it's kind of almost close, right? So using this, you can easily figure out if you take the complex conjugate of psi L and multiply it by psi 2, then that object transforms like hang on. Yes. Oh, right. Very good question. Yes. So we are working in the Weyl basis, in the Weyl representation. And in the Weyl representation, psi Dirac is basically psi L and psi R. So in the Weyl representation, when I mean psi L, so basically, yeah, that's, this is, I am identifying these two things. Okay? So is that, this is the psi D, yes. Yes. Right. Yeah. Okay. So if I use the way that psi L transforms here and take its complex conjugate, then the fact that sigmas are Hermitian, well, they have their complex conjugate properties, which is encoded in that expression. And here I flips a sign, and in used use this guy to figure this, to work this out. So that means that sigma 2 psi L star, you know, that transformed like psi R. So up to some transformation, psi L and psi R, the two, their transformation properties are related by complex conjugation. Okay? Oh, you just work it out. You start with psi L there, take its complex conjugate, and then multiply by psi 2 using this relationship, and the relationships of the Pauli matrices, and that's what you find. Yes?
Are you done kind of showing that they're not equivalent representations?
Yeah.
How do you know that they're not equivalent exactly? How do you know that you can find some similarity?
Well, I don't know the I mean, I think it's, if you think about it carefully, then maybe this argument will actually be convincing. The fact that there is psi 5 and psi 5 commutes with all the, you know, the Lorentz algebra, by Schur's lemma, you are ensured that these two things are, well, they're reducible. That's what it's, what Schur's lemma tell you. But the thing is that psi 5 is not the identity matrix. It has eigenvalue plus 1 and minus 1. And because they're different eigenvalues, they are, they must be different representations. So I'm kind of, you know, arguing from a mathematical point of view, but explicitly, if you just think of these guys, you can see that they are, you know, that that there is no transformation which will take, okay, yeah. So the way to do this is to basically write this out in terms of the sigma matrices and ones, and then try to prove using the properties of the Pauli matrices whether, you know, there is such a unitary transformation. And you can show that there is none. So that's not really a real answer, but you know, I haven't tried to actually prove it myself, so I cannot give you more detail on that. Okay. Okay, so I have about 15 minutes left, so I'm gonna breeze through the rest of the 10 pages of my notes. So what we have shown is that the left-handed representation is you take the complex conjugation, it's related to the right-handed representation. Okay. Okay, I'm not gonna say anything about this, I'm just gonna mention it. But at the Lie algebra level, the Lorentz algebra, group algebra, is actually given by two copies of the SU2 algebra. One relates to the to this representation. The other one relates to that representation. Anyway, I won't have time to go into that in a lot of detail. So in the last 15 minutes, I want to tell you about parity. Okay. So if you take a Dirac matrix, so now we are, and take its Hermitian conjugate, then you can show that this relates to the original by this kind of transformation, okay? Now, you can verify that for the chiral representation, the Waal representation. I should also say, at this point, that the Waal representation is also known as the chiral representation. So at some point, I'll just use those two terms interchangeably, Waal representation and chiral representation. So the gamma mu is related to gamma mu dagger in this way. So this allows us to work out what the conjugate, Hermitian conjugate of the generators are. And so the generators, so there was an I in the generator. Under the dagger, that becomes minus I. And there's a commutator. There's a dagger on the commutator. But we know that when we take the dagger of product of matrices, the ordering changes. So when we take the dagger inside, the gamma nu, this become this they switch side, and but this is anisometric in mu and nu, so we can write as like this. So, and from here we find that we have gamma 0, gamma mu. So we can derive that. So this means that if we have a Dirac spinner and it is transforming according to, it's transforming like so. I'm just not gonna bother with the argument here. The argument. Then the Hermitian conjugate of the Dirac spinner is you just take the Hermitian conjugate of this guy, is this become plus I by 2 omega mu nu, so gamma mu nu dagger, right? So what we have shown, okay, what I'm trying to do is that I'm trying to construct out of the spinners a scalar quantity, okay? Because our Lagrangian at the end of the day is going to be a scalar. So we want scalars. But what this shows is that our naive like expectation that this would be a scalar is doomed. That's because this guy is not going to cancel out this guy. Because gamma mu nu is not Hermitian. If we were to restrict to the rotational subgroup, then under rotation this would be invariant, but not under the full Lorentz group. However, this this formula gives us a way out. And so we can define psi bar, which I will call the, which is psi dagger times gamma 0. And this is called the Dirac conjugate. So then you can very easily see that the if psi of x, if psi transforms in this way, then psi bar transforms in the opposite way so that this guy. Now let me put in the space-time dependence. Transforms under a Lorentz transformation like a scalar. Okay? So all the Lorentz invariant or covariant objects that we are going to be interested in can be classified under a transformation called parity. So what is parity? Sorry? Oh my God. Yeah, thank you very much. I appreciate that you're paying attention at 5 o'clock in the afternoon, in the evening. That's amazing. I have about 5 minutes to cover 5 pages. Okay. So I'm probably not going to go through this today, the whole of it. So parity. So let's complement our Lorentz group by a discrete transformation called P, which acts on space-time coordinates in the Cartesian coordinate system, like so. So it just inverts all the spatial directions. And you can convince yourself that this transformation is equivalent to a reflection through a mirror plus a rotation. Okay? And this has determinant minus one. That means that it is not part of the SO1, 3 group. So parity is not an element of the Lorentz group. Why? Because all the elements of Lorentz group have identity determinant. That's what the S stands for. But P is an element of O1, 3. So P is, because it's a discrete transformation, it is not related continuously to the identity. However, because P is element of this, means that P actually leaves the Minkowski metric, you know, invariant. Okay. So under parity, the helicity of a spinner flips. So what is the helicity of the spinner? So here I'm going to appeal to a little bit of your physical knowledge about spinners from, say, quantum mechanics. And you can say, suppose you have a spinning object which is also moving, right? So you can think of it, so it has some momentum, P, and it is has some kind of, you know, spin property, some kind of, you know, it is also described by a spinner, like a two-dimensional Pauli spinner. Then the helicity of a two-dimensional spinner is defined to be the projection of the spin along its direction of momentum, and we divide it by the magnitude of the momentum. Now, under parity, what happens is that, okay, let's see how under reflection such an object, so this is our mirror, and this is the direction of P, and this is the direction of this of the rotation of the object. So under reflection, P goes to minus P, right? So this is the momentum of this guy is opposite of the momentum of this guy, right? But its direction of rotation does not change under under parity. Okay? So you might say, okay, you're really cheating because what if I was going this way? Then under this reflection, what will happen is that even the momentum will not change. So the key thing to keep in mind is that we are thinking about parity, which is actually in this setup is a reflection through this mirror and then a rotation, you know, in this by rotation by 180 degrees in the plane of the mirror. So this thing does not change under that rotation, but if the object was going this way, that rotation would actually flip that the direction of the momentum. Yes? It is a quantum mechanical. It is from taken from quantum mechanics, but you can think of the sigma acting on a two-dimensional spinner. You know, it could be a vowel spinner. It's. I'm just using it very heuristically to motivate parity. Okay. So. Right. So what I'm kind of trying to say is that under parity, P goes to the left-handed representation, a spinner, a two-dimensional spinner, which is in the left-handed representation, you know, goes to a right-handed representation. Okay? This is basically what I'm trying to motivate. So that, you know, a parity which should act in this way, right? It would take L, the left-handed spinner, to the right-handed spinner, and right-handed spinner to left-handed spinner, right? This is basically what I'm trying to motivate. So how can we do this? Well, there is, in the chiral representation, this can be done by saying, if this psi is a Dirac spinner, then under parity, it goes to gamma zero of psi of the spatial components go to minus x, the t component remains the same. So I should probably do this. Spatial components, okay? So all these things is just to kind of, you know, motivate that I want my Dirac spinners to transform like so under parity. And so I am out of time. Is it possible to have a couple of more minutes? Okay, nobody's in a hurry? Okay, you see, I'm competing with Pedro, who is teaching CFT over there. If I can finish before Pedro, I'll be on the good books of the AV people. Okay. So why are we doing this? The idea is that we want to classify the different combinations of the spinners under parity, how they transform under parity. So under parity, then you can very easily show that psi of the thing that we call the scalar, you know, remains the same. Although its argument, you know, changes. And this is, so under, when something transforms like this, under parity, and it is a scalar in the Lorentz transformation sense, we call it a scalar. But what if we consider this guy, then just using this rule and the properties of the gamma 5, how gamma 5 behaves, the fact that gamma 5 anti-commutes with gamma 0, you can show that under parity, this guy picks up a minus sign. So such objects are called pseudo-scalars. So pseudoscalars under Lorentz transformation, the regular rotation and boost, will act, will transform like a scalar. But under parity, they pick up a minus sign. Okay? So that is what is a pseudoscalar. So, you know, a vector, a three-dimensional vector, when you under parity should pick, sorry, a four-dimensional vector under parity should pick up a minus sign in its spatial components, and its time component should remain invariant, right? And then you can show that if you sandwich the set of gamma matrices within a spinner and its Dirac conjugate, then under parity, the zeroth component does not change. It remains this. However, the spatial components do pick up a minus sign. And such objects we call a vector. Okay? And lastly, okay. Because we're on the last line, I can use the black, the fourth blackboard, which does not move. Yes? Yeah, there is a gamma minus sign. Oh, yeah. You're right. Yeah. Oh, sorry. Yeah. So now if we consider the combination, this thing, then under parity, the zeroth component picks up now a minus sign. Whereas the spatial components do not pick up a minus sign. And such an object is called a pseudo vector. Or an axial vector. Nature, it turns out, is not invariant under parity. And the Lagrangian or weak interaction contains a current which has the structure of V minus A, where A and B are coefficients. And A and B are actually one, which means that not only does nature violate parity in weak interactions, it violates parity maximally. Okay, so, and I'll stop there.